This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Stay Hungry by Sebastian Maniscalco. Read by the author.
Intro. I'm starving. When I started working on this book, I thought, who the hell are you to write a memoir? You're not an economist, president, scientist, or pro wrestler. True. I'm none of those things. I don't even know how to speak right. But here I am, typing the words, and some of them even have multiple syllables. I'm a comedian. My claim to authorship is my talent for making observations about people that come out in a funny way. My comedy's based on my own life, how I come from Chicago, that I'm the son of an Italian immigrant father, that I'm married to a woman who's out of my league, and that I'm easily annoyed by people. If you're a fan, or at the very least could pronounce my last name, which is exactly how it's spelled, but still nobody could pronounce it, Maniscalco, you probably knew all this about me already. And if you didn't, and are just listening to this book in your car as you go to work, well, now you do. Another thing about me, I'm constantly starving. My entire day is planned around food. What's for breakfast? Should I scramble a couple eggs like a normal human, or wolf down the dozen my appetite is telling me to do? There are no leftovers with me. The only thing that's possibly left over is a spot on my shirt. My wife Lana and I go to every new restaurant in L.A. where we live and travel to a variety of restaurants all over the world. I know a lot about food and keep current on the food scene, watch all the chef shows, Top Chef is my favorite, and seek out phenomenal food. But I hate the word foodie as much, if not more, than the word selfie. I have breakfast, lunch, and dinner with multiple snacks in between. My wife will say, babe, don't ruin your appetite. I don't even know what that means. My appetite is impenetrable. My father and I sit around, talk, eat, and justify the indulgence by reconfirming to each other how good the food is. In one sitting, we have Italian bread, meat, fruit, olives, olive oil, gelato. It doesn't stop. We push ourselves to the limit. Not dissimilar to the Nathan's famous hot dog eating contest. We just frame it a little bit more elegantly. Instead of using water to wash down just one more bite that we could swallow otherwise, we use Cabernet. Tiger Woods' father, Earl, pushed him to become better at golf. My father pushed me to eat tripe. He said, it's a delicacy. I would roll my eyes and say, gross. No, it's the lining of a cow's stomach. My grandfather couldn't even speak English. So we communicated through pasta, rigatoni, cavatelli, pappardelle. As you listen to this book, you'll see how cuisine always finds its way to the heart of my stories, even if they're about something completely different. Some food rules of mine. I don't eat around my computer. I don't want crumbs wedged between the control and the escape keys. Some people say, I don't shit where I eat. Well, I don't eat where I work. A meal for me is time to chew the fat, to digest the day while filling up on food, recap, stories. I don't do quick bites, drive-thrus, or eat at a stoplight. I need a proper setup. The dinner table is my informal stage where I work out material. There's nothing quick about my meals. The longer, the better. We may even sit so long one meal bleeds into the next. Food relaxes me. Not eating gives me a nervous, wide-awake energy. The longer I go without eating a full meal, the more I get done. So I don't eat if I have things to do, like perform comedy. The day of the show, I have breakfast, a light lunch, but I skip dinner to get that hungry edge. If you've seen my stand-up or watched my Showtime specials, you know that I'm constantly moving up there, working up an appetite like a bear just awoken from an hibernation. As soon as the set is over, I must beeline into the dressing room, change into a dry shirt, and head to dinner before I could even talk about what went on in the show. Even if it's 1 a.m, I don't say, nah, I'm just going to go to bed. Some people grab a drink post-set. I'm ready for a full-blown spread, appetizers, entrees, desserts, and everything in between. Problem is, I'm always trying to stay fit. My wife is like my coach, letting me know when I'm allowed to have something or not. Funny game we play? We act like I'm in trouble or sneaking food every time I eat. Like she's catching me with my hand in the cookie jar. In my family, you don't open anything without finishing it. My wife will save one cookie, eating it little by little over the course of 3 weeks. Lana's so tuned in, she knows by my footsteps as I enter the house whether I stop for lunch, and she could always guess what I had. Some guys come home and take a shower because they're having an affair. I have to wash off the stench of onions in my burrito. There's one major aspect of my life where I don't overindulge, fill up, or even let myself feel satisfied. My career. My recipe for success is to stay hungry. I never let myself bask in any glory. My father's voice is like a broken record constantly playing in my head saying, "Don't get comfortable. Nothing comes easy for the Maniscalcos. Get back to work." When I first came to L.A. at 24 to become a stand-up comedian, everything I owned fit in my car. I didn't know anything about making it in comedy or know anyone in that world. All I had was a dream, a hunger for success, and an insatiable work ethic that came from my father. I cannot not work. It's like a sickness. I don't have a choice about staying hungry, metaphorically or even literally. My early years in L.A., working as a cocktail waitress at the Four Seasons Windows Lounge and surviving on tips and loose crumbs from the kitchen. I was thrown scraps of hope doing open mic nights and unpaid gigs at bowling alleys, boxing rings. But for the most part, I begged for stage time in exchange for bar snacks, if that. Even when things did break for me, I didn't let those small successes go to my head or fill my stomach. A taste of success usually turned out to be just that, a sample. A few months after, say, opening for Andrew Dice Clay at the Stardust in Vegas, or touring the Heartland on a bus with 3 other comics and Vince Vaughn, or getting the green light to write and star in a network sitcom, I'd find myself right back in that what's next mindset of being between gigs and meals. Feeling the hunger. This insatiable feeling about stand-up comedy hasn't let up in 20 years, and it probably never will, even though that I'm selling out theaters, touring the world, and writing a memoir. Here's the thing, I'm just as hungry now as I ever was. In fact, I'm starving. Now I'm going to pause for a sec. My dad just walked in, and I'm going to make an antipasti plate. I suggest you do the same. Chapter 1. Leftovers. If you want to work in the stock market, you go to New York. If you want to grow corn, you go to Nebraska. If you want to get into entertainment, you go to Los Angeles. So as soon as I'd saved what I considered a solid chunk, 10 grand, I was going to move out there and become a stand-up comedian. Before I headed west, I thought it'd be wise and considerate to alert Hollywood that I was on my way. It was a version of calling ahead, like when I was in high school and I called my mom to let her know I'd be late for curfew. She said, "If you're gonna be late, just let me know." I would stop whatever I was doing, dancing at a nightclub, having a bialy or clam chowder at a Greek diner, make up an excuse to my friends, and sneak off to a payphone to call her. I was the only one of my friends who had to call home to mommy. They had parents who could give a shit. But my mom was a worrier and still is. "Hey, Mom, we're at Omega. Looks like we're going to be running a little late tonight. I'll be home around 2 a.m. Don't wait up." She always said, "Be careful," and waited up anyway. Sending the news of my imminent arrival to L.A. was an extension of that. You call ahead. You tell the relevant people what's going on. It is just polite. And I already had a headshot to use, taken by a professional photographer. That's a story in itself. In college, I heard one of those Barbizon ads on the radio that said, "Do you think you have what it takes to be a model? Come down to the Hilton this Saturday, dressed to impress, and meet one of our top model scouts from New York City." Every Italian kid grows up thinking he's gorgeous because his mother tells him every day. I heard this even when I had an insane mullet in eighth grade. At 21, the mullet was long gone, and I thought I could make some cash on the side as a model. This is my shot. Finally, I'm going to get discovered. I looked at GQ magazines for inspirations about what to wear, pulled together a look by combining pieces from my grandfather's and father's wardrobes, and went to the Hilton. They handed me a questionnaire to fill out. One of the questions was, "What celebrity do you resemble?" I wrote in Antonio Sabato Jr. Every Italian who grew up in the 80s wish he looked like Antonio. The Barbizon photographer set me up in a variety of outfits and poses he called the shots. One was in Hanes Tidy Whiteys in a stairwell, a shot that said, "I'm relaxed, but I gotta run." He draped a sweater over my pecs for a shot that said, "I'm cold, but I'm hot." I was game. I took it seriously. I channeled the raw sex appeal of Antonio and nailed it. I wrote a check for $300, money I'd saved working in the cafeteria, scooping potato salad with a hairnet while trying to pick up chicks. You know the charm you have to generate to land a girl while dunking the ice cream scooper in hot water between serving macaroni salad and the slaw? More than I had, apparently. A few weeks later, I got my headshots in the mail and never heard from Barbizon again. Or got any modeling gigs. The only place my headshot was featured was in a frame on my mom's living room coffee table. "Stunning," she said. She showed it to everyone who came over. For my Hollywood announcement, I got clever. I made a copy of my headshot, and using a photo editing program on my computer, I made it look like my face was on a movie screen with a bunch of silhouette audience heads watching me. The caption, "Coming soon to Los Angeles, Sebastian." I intentionally didn't include my last name, phone number, or email address because I was building a sense of intrigue and mystery, ratcheting up the anticipation. I printed out 100 copies and sent them to every agent and casting director in Hollywood. I assumed people would be impressed, and I knew my mailing would stand out because it was a larger-than-regular envelope, and the envelope was black, which was unheard of. They would chuckle at my cleverness and flip the headshot over to look for my contact info, since they would want to call me immediately. Finding no number and no address, they think, "This Sebastian character sure knows how to develop dramatic tension." I imagine them pinning up the picture, waiting with barely contained eagerness for me to send another. Now, I'm aware more typical path for a comedian is to do stand-up in your town, get your feet wet, develop some chops, and then go to New York or Los Angeles. But with my trademark delusional optimism, I figured, why don't I just dive in head first? Since I'd be in Hollywood, I figured I'd do a little acting in movies and TV, make money on the side until I became a successful comedian. I went out for a short visit first. The only person I knew in L.A. was Dean Viverito, the son of my dentist. When you're from somewhere other than Los Angeles, you will connect with anyone within 10 degrees of separation. We used to live in the same city and didn't hang out once. But you move out of town and suddenly I'm asking, "Do you have toothpaste?" Back then, there was no Airbnb. You slept on the couch of someone you knew or barely knew. These days, you sleep on the couch of a complete stranger. They could have fleas, bed bugs, hepatitis C. God knows what type of diseases are in the cushions of a strange couch that three roommates have been flicking boogers on and farting into after late-night burrito runs. Dean's place was clean, though. His wife was a working actress. Her career gave me a glimmer of hope that it was possible to make things happen out here. I was respectful of their space and lived out of my bag. I didn't even use their toilet. I went to the 7-Eleven instead. and I only stayed for 3 days. When I came back, I wasn't going to sleep on anybody's couch long term. I'd rather have a cheap apartment of my own than impose on anybody else. 2 months later, I returned to L.A. to stay. All of my possessions fit into a single suitcase. I had my clothes, the $10,000 I saved up from working at many jobs, and a stack of stamped follow-up headshot mailings. I used the same image as before with a different headline. Now playing Sebastian. I included my contact information on the second wave, which would relieve anxiety of all those agents who've been dying to get in touch with me since my previous mailing. I even upped my cell phone minutes in anticipation of being inundated with calls. Looking back, I know mailing the announcements was naive, but I didn't even know any better. I did what I thought was right. Since I was putting in so much effort, I assumed that, out of basic human courtesy, something I'm very cautious of, agents would acknowledge my effort, even just to say, "You got courage, kid. I like your style." I started to learn, however, that Los Angeles was not a basic human courtesy kind of town. No one called me or acknowledged my mailings at all. Meanwhile, I started looking for an apartment and found an okay one-bedroom at the St. James apartment on Hollywood Boulevard in Fuller for $685 a month. The apartment complex had 200 units, probably filled with other aspiring actors and comedians. I say probably because I didn't know any of them. A huge adjustment to living in Los Angeles was that no one knows their neighbors. Back home, you could pop over to a neighbor's house and borrow a cup of sugar. Why are people always out of sugar? In my apartment complex in L.A., people didn't eat sugar, much less borrow it. The place was so seedy, the only white powder they'd have was cocaine. And unless you were their dealer, they weren't opening the door for you. One exception at the St. James, I popped into an elevator one day and saw Bill Burr, one of my favorite comedians. I couldn't believe he was in there. It turned out he lived in the building. I was in complete shock, but I tried to play it cool. He invited me to his show at the Laugh Factory, my first exposure to a comedy club in L.A. A lot of the other residents hung out by the pool, but I wasn't into it. Come on. Public swimming pool? Taking a dip would be like marinating in a stew of 200 strangers' scabs and broken dreams. The water looked okay, but I could think of 10 skin conditions it could give me, and I hadn't budgeted for penicillin. My third-floor apartment faced another complex. My first morning, I was standing at the stove cooking some eggs. I casually glanced out my only window, which was over the kitchen sink and faced another building. I could not make this up if I wanted to. A guy in the apartment across the way was naked, locking eyes with me, and fucking his couch. Welcome to Hollywood! Instantly, I closed the curtains. An hour later, I dared to peek out. My creepy neighbor was still at it, humping his Jennifer convertible. A while after that, he was standing full frontal nude in the window. He was always there, always naked. I guess he didn't have a job or any hobbies other than being a furniture lover. I called the St. James management to ask if I could change units. I explained why. The landlord said, "Oh, that's just Paul. He's harmless." Well, tell that to the poor couch. Harmless or not, I still wanted to move. The landlord told me that when another place opened up, he'd let me know, but it might not be for a while. In the meantime, I kept my curtains closed and stumbled around in the dark, which is a pretty good metaphor for my clueless early months in Los Angeles. I figured $10,000 would be enough to get me started, but I knew it wouldn't last long, so I went looking for a restaurant job. Instead of just walking in and asking if they needed help, I would sit down, have a meal, and decided beforehand if I'd like the environment, the people, of course, and the food. Only then I would go to the manager and say, "I just had lunch here and I really liked the place. I'm new to town. I was wondering if it'd be possible to work here." Invariably, they would say, "We're not hiring." I'd sulk out, wondering if the $40 I just dropped was ill-spent. Whenever I thought about lowering my standards and working at a place I didn't pre-approve, I'd remind myself that I was starting a new life and that it was not going to begin with a compromise. The plan from the beginning was to get a good job in a nice place for a decent wage to supplement my income while I pursued comedy. I'm sure thousands of people arrive in L.A. each month with the same exact plan, and that was why I couldn't find a job to save my life. All those other would-be actors and comedians beat me to them. It was especially frustrating because I had tons of experience. I worked as a banquet waiter throughout college, at the Olive Garden, at a high-end restaurant in the northwest suburbs of Chicago called The Living Room. In the past, I never had a hard time getting hired, but L.A. was not Chicago. Out here, I was competing for waiter jobs with the next Bradley Cooper from Kansas or the next Jennifer Lawrence from New Jersey. One place asked me for my headshot. I was so proud to leave it. I said, absolutely. Here you go. I got underwear in the stairs and sweater over the pecs and weeds. Take your pick. Not only did the casting directors not call me back, neither did the failed actor's manager at Il Fornaio. At the end of 3 months, I was down to $3,000. I couldn't ask my parents for help. That would be humiliating. I came up with a scheme to beef up my savings until I landed a job. I would fly to Las Vegas, win money, and keep my dream alive. The logic had some holes in it, real big holes, big enough to drive a tank through, but I was desperate. When you feel like you're spiraling, your mind goes down a dark path and you just grasp at any straw to get out of it. I've been asking myself 100 times a day, what the hell do I do now? The Vegas idea appeared in my head, and I let my imagination take over. I could see myself at the tables winning, and I became convinced that my daydreams were just one plane ride away from turning into a reality. Part of my brain was screaming, "No, Sebastian!" But the much louder part said, "Just don't hit on 17. You'll be fine." I got free flights because after college, I worked at United Airlines Employees Credit Union and retained my privileges until the end of the month. I took advantage. I did a quick round trip in a single day to avoid paying for a hotel room. To get to town, I hopped on the free airport shuttle. I didn't eat any meals. I just licked a bag of peanuts on the airplane. The trip was no mini vacation. It was work. My sole intention was to rake it in at the blackjack table and play this one specific Wheel of Fortune machine at the Treasure Island. I'd hit it before with my buddies when I went to Vegas for spring break during college. I won a grand. I thought, I'll just do that again, easy, and pay my rent for the next month. I took the airport shuttle bus directly to my lucky casino and searched for that Wheel of Fortune machine. I went to the bank of slots where it had been before, but it was gone. Since I'd last been to Treasure Island, the casino had been remodeled, and my lucky machine had been moved. I couldn't find it anywhere, and believe me, I looked. I was able to find 24 blackjack tables. I sat down, changed my bills into chips, stuck to my rules, played smart, and lost $1,000. It happened so fast. In less than 2 hours, my money was gone. I went back to the airport with empty pockets, miserable, discouraged, and yet still hopeful. I decided the bad day was a fluke. My daydreams of repeating my past big win were too vivid, too clear to be wrong. I believed with my whole heart I was foreseeing the future. A few weeks later, I returned to Vegas and did much better the second time. I lost $800. I couldn't even laugh it off with my L.A. friends because I didn't have any. I could have turned to my parents to console me, but when I called home, I felt compelled to pretend everything was okay. In the back of my head, I was thinking, I'll get out of this. Everything will be okay. So when I told Mom and Dad it was fine, it didn't feel like it was lying. It put a big lump in my throat, though. If my father had any idea I'd pissed away in Vegas the money I scraped together for years, he would have given me a lecture that only a Sicilian father could pull off, the kind that burns your soul over the telephone. Keeping things from my parents made me feel even lonelier, which didn't seem possible. I wasn't used to this level of isolation. I came from a very bonded family and a tight group of friends who were like family. Although my father was an immigrant, he was Americanized at the salon where he worked as a beautician. He used his gift of gab to talk to people while doing their hair. A lot of my parents' friends came from the old country, too. They did cement work or jobs that didn't interact with people that much, so they would hang out at our place to watch my dad listen and learn. After a shift at Fuddruckers, where we all worked, we would go to my house to play foosball in the basement till 3 a.m. The smell in the air of freshly baked lasagna and tagliatelle alle olio, mixed with downy dryer sheets and the sound of sneaker laces hitting the inside of the dryer. My family loved having people over, especially my mom. She would bring out food for the guest, the secret Entenmann stash. And we would sit at the kitchen table and joke around over coffee and cake. The house itself was one of those newer models on the street. And because it was set at the corner, it made a big impression. When my friends saw it for the first time, the manicured lawn, the white brick facade, they say, "You live in a mansion!" In my neighborhood, our 2,100-square-foot home was different from others on the block. They were one-story ranch houses with aluminum siding. Ours was two stories with a backyard that resembled Mr. Miyagi's. My father had a bonsai tree and other exotic plants that should never been able to live in Illinois. The only thing missing was Danielson doing wax on, wax off. Inside the house was immaculate. Unless you walk down to the basement, where there was a lot of shit my father couldn't let go of. He never threw anything out, including a dry sauna that he had disassembled from his old salon. Maybe he believes the day will come when someone needs to shed some weight for a wrestling competition. Or maybe he thinks this vintage sauna is appreciating in value? Regardless, it's in the crawl space just in case. Most people inherit property or family heirlooms when their parents pass away, but my inheritance is going to be slabs of cedar wood that have disintegrated over time or are ridden with termites. Basically, my inheritance will be a trash removal bill. So I went from that environment, a welcoming, warm home with tons of people coming and going, to my one bedroom in Hollywood with a naked man outside my only window. Months went by, and I was the only person in and out of my apartment. I had left home before for college, but campus was only an hour away from my parents' house. I could drive home to do laundry and get a square of lasagna. L.A. was a 4.5-hour flight away from everybody I knew and loved. For companionship, even Paul the Pervert had his sectional, but I was totally on my own. More than anything, I was determined not to limp home to Chicago broke in more ways than one, and a failure after only a few months. It would have been too embarrassing to bear. When I was growing up, the number one cardinal sin was embarrassing my family. I'd done it once in third grade. My friends and I carried a kid over our heads at recess. He didn't enjoy being handled like a bag of potatoes, though, and we were sent to the principal's office. The principal at the time, Mrs. Gifford, a petite, white-haired, beady-eyed ex-nun who could have doubled as a prison warden, looked at me and said, "Sebastian, I'd never thought I'd see you in here. I'm going to call your parents, and they're going to be very disappointed in you." That struck terror in me. The queasy feeling of doing something that disappointed or embarrassed my parents became the only thing I never wanted to experience again. From then on, I was always mindful not to disappoint them. I was a good kid. I stayed out of trouble. My friends were also good kids from good families. I didn't do drugs or drink too much, even when I was in a fraternity. The idea of my mom telling her friends, "Sebastian's an alcoholic," or "my son's an addict," was enough to keep me away from that. Anything that would cast my family in a bad light was undoable, unthinkable. I was so overly cautious of not embarrassing them, I became hyper-aware of people doing embarrassing things that, if I did them, would shame my family. Zeroing in on the bad behavior of others did become like a superpower for me. I didn't judge people. I exercised judgment. I cannot not notice or unsee people's behavior. And that insight turns up in my comedy, hence the special, "Aren't You Embarrassed?" My sister Jessica never lost sleep over making a bad impression for our family. She was blasé about spending time with us. After dinner, she'd run upstairs, talk to her friends on the phone, and listen to New Kids on the Block. When I asked her why she didn't bring her friends over and hang out more with Mom and Dad, she said, "Oh, they're so embarrassing." She was worried about them embarrassing her. If I had that attitude, I would have been less anxious. But then I wouldn't have developed these observational skills and senses of a feline. It's an even trade. What I'm getting at, my goal has always been to make my family proud. The thought of my mom saying my son moved to L.A. and tanked in 3 months was enough to get me back out there, resumes in hand. With about $500 in my savings account, I expanded my job search from restaurants to hotels. I thought maybe I could work in room service. I popped into the Sofitel and asked the person in human resources, "You got any positions?" He said, "We don't, but the Four Seasons in Beverly Hills is always hiring. Go there." I'd never even heard of the Four Seasons brand before, and certainly never stayed at a starred hotel. The nicest place my family went was the Marriott. I didn't know to be intimidated by how fancy the Four Seasons was when I went over there to fill out an application for a room service job. There were more interviews at the Four Seasons than to work for the CIA. I went from department to department over the course of 3 weeks, and the final interview was with Sean Lawful, the director of food and beverage. He made me sit outside on the couch for 40 minutes. And in my head, I was thinking, this motherfucker, they put me through all this, and now they're making me wait? I was so close to leaving. And if I had, it would have been one of those small decisions that had a domino effect on the direction of my life. Without my job at the Four Seasons, which allowed me the flexibility I needed to pursue comedy, I might have never achieved what I have today. At the interview, Sean and I sat on the couches facing each other in the hotel lobby. And I pull it all out there, telling him, "Listen, man, I'm from Chicago. I'm new out here. I really need a job. I got great work ethic. I'll always be on time, and I'll do whatever you need done." Sean was just looking at me, smiling. I wondered if he was even paying attention. And then he said, "Your accent really brings me home. I'm from Chicago, too." I was desperately homesick. And by talking to me, he got a little homesick, too. I guess he liked the idea of hearing more of my accent. He goes, "You're not room service material. You need to be around people. I'm going to put you in the bar serving cocktails." A job offer. Finally, I said, "Okay, man, great." The Four Seasons lobby bar, the Windows Lounge, turned out to be the place to be seen in Beverly Hills or to take an industry meeting. Celebrities were in and out of there constantly. I'd be only one of two guys working there amongst a handful of women. I called myself a cocktail waitress because at the time in 1998, working in a cocktail lounge was reserved for women. They gave me a penguin outfit, and I didn't give a shit. I was so relieved to have a job, and was only hoping my naked neighbor would sublet his apartment to a female nudist friend. It was all because of my accent. I got my start in L.A. thanks to my Illinois roots. Thank God for Sean. I don't know what the hell would have happened to me if I hadn't gotten that job. And so I began my career as a cocktail server. I was a new guy, eager with a big smile and wide eyes. If I saw my younger self now, I would turn to my buddy and say, "Wow, that guy is green." But I was just awed by it all. It was as if I'd been dropped into the center of Hollywood where it was all happening. My first day of work, I saw Sylvester Stallone walk through. In all my years of serving food, I never waited on a celebrity before. Never been close to anybody famous besides Bozo the Clown. I was on the Bozo show with my neighbor John Papadia. We played the Bozo Buckets. I lost. That was my claim to fame until Stallone. All of a sudden, I was serving Sean Penn at his usual table, number 146 on the patio. Very intense, a great tipper. He always ordered spicy tuna rolls. I probably served him 50 times over the years, but we never chatted. He was nice, but he radiated an intimidating energy that said, "I don't schmooze." Over at table 147, I had to take an order from Nicole Kidman. Talk about stunning. She had an A-list glow about her. Then I had to deliver a fruit plate to Shaquille O'Neal. Shaq was in on Sunday nights. He was a regular. I felt like I was serving a giant. I would give him a dessert spoon with his cappuccino because you can't give a man like that a tiny coffee spoon. I'd be like a Barbie utensil for him. He was a great tipper, too, always leaving a $100 bill underneath the plate. One night, right before closing, John Travolta came in with another guy and sat at my table, 113. They were both wearing workout clothes, so I assumed the other guy was Travolta's trainer. I greeted them within 3 minutes, the bar rule. I put down the nut caddy, our famous bar snack. Travolta glanced at the menu, ordered a burger, which seemed like an odd choice at midnight after a workout. I was starstruck by him, I admit. I've been a huge fan of his growing up, and serving him a burger blew my mind. Most of the customers barely acknowledged me at all, but he was chatty, just making small talk. At one point, he took a close look at me and said, "You got great legs." "Oh," I said, "thanks." "What do you do?" "Oh, I'm a comedian." "No, for your legs." "Oh, for my legs?" I paused. "I run laps around here getting people drinks, and I played soccer in high school." "Well, they look good." I didn't mind that we were two men discussing the allure of my bulging legs. By the way, back then, they were solid. I was flattered. It wasn't a life-changing moment, but I was still a cocktail waitress trying to catch a break. It gave me a lift. Never once while watching Welcome Back, Kotter, did I think Vinnie Bombarino would compliment my quads one day. I adapted quickly to the four-season system. I figured out how to game it. Technically, I was only part-time, star for shifts. I made a habit of showing up in my uniform, even if I wasn't scheduled, offering to pick up shifts from other servers. I'd hover over the time clock where people punched in and ask, "You want to go home? Because I'll work your shift for you." No one wanted to be there. The other servers were all actors and actresses who'd rather work on their tans or their crafts than fetch pomfrites and martinis for snobby customers. I noticed the work ethic wasn't deeply rooted in them as it was in me. If they said, "I wish I could take off, but I need the money," I'd say, "No problem." I'd wait for the 3:30 p.m. person to show up. If they turned down the offer, I'd wait until the 4:30 person came in. I sat there for 2 hours, hoping someone felt lazy enough to leave. 9 times out of 10, I'd pick up a shift that way. The more I worked, the bigger my cushion, so if I ever needed to take a day off to, say, perform comedy somewhere, I could. In the meantime, I worked every chance I got. I begged for it. I was sort of like the guys who linger in the parking lot at Home Depot, just in a fancier environment. At the hotel, there was a cafeteria in the basement for the staff. Housekeeping, room service, and servers were not allowed to eat the shrimp cocktail and steak on the restaurant menus, but the hotel did provide meatloaf, mashed potato, and pasta to their workers as a side benefit. You were only supposed to eat at the cafeteria when you were working, but on my days off, I'd put on my uniform and go there anyway to save money. When I was on shift, I'd eat in the cafeteria beforehand, on my break, and afterwards. The Four Seasons fed me 3 meals a day. Let's say somebody came into the bar and ordered a spicy tuna roll, and then got a life-changing call and ran out just as the food arrived at the table. Now, according to the rules, I was supposed to take the plate of untouched food back to the kitchen and throw it in the garbage. But I would eat it. Or let's say my favorite dessert on the menu, a chocolate pudding cake, devil's food on the outside, hot molten chocolate on the inside, that oozed out when you cut into it with a fork happened to break while it was being plated. We were supposed to throw that away, too, but I would scarf it. Who wouldn't? Was it stealing? Eating the house food was definitely forbidden, but it was going to be trash anyway. By my code of ethics, this didn't seem wrong. Eating pre-garbage was something we servers helped each other get away with and bonded over. That and complaining about rude, vain, cheap tippers was how I made my first crew of friends in Los Angeles. Remember that one male cocktail waiter? His name is Dan Westerman, a seriously funny guy. Dan was a furniture mover who decided to move out to be an actor at the age of 34. So he did what other actors do. He started waiting tables. I have no idea how he got the job. He is a great, big-hearted, generous guy, but a terrible waiter. His section could have one person in it and be running around drenched with beads of sweat pouring off his lip. That said, he taught me all the tricks about working at the Four Seasons. Dan and I were both pursuing our dreams in the entertainment business. We became tight and we hung out after our shifts at St. Nick's on 3rd Street, a dive bar with a jukebox. We'd have a drink or two, bitch about work, commiserate over shared experiences. The nature of workplace relationship is that as soon as you get out of the same environment, you have nothing in common, and a lot of those friendships fade. This proved to be true with most, but not all, of the people I met then. Dan and I are still friends. He came to my wedding a few years ago. But when you're in the trenches together, you really get close, real fast. The Four Seasons provided me with dates as well. Not dates as in the strange, most dry, sweet, strange textured fruit on the planet. I mean women. Sometimes I'd drop the nuts on the table. I'm talking about the nut dish. For a random female customer and we'd start talking. If the vibe was right, I'd ask, you want to go to dinner? Cruising at work wasn't my M.O., but if a good-looking girl came in and seemed to hit it off, I definitely would not shy away from it. One girl, a regular, came out with me to a nice Italian joint. We sat down. I bought a couple glasses of wine out of my price range. She ordered the veal scallopini, and I got the chicken picante. It was your average first date. You know, where are you from? How many siblings do you have? What are your hobbies, etc.? After I put down my fork, she looked at my plate and asked, you gonna finish that? I said, nah, and I had a big portion. Oh, cool. Do you mind if I take it home for lunch tomorrow? I thought, what? She making a profit off this? It was one thing to eat off someone's plate, but this woman wanted to eat out of my doggy bag. I was taken by surprise and stammered. Oh, yeah, yeah. Go ahead. I would no doubt feel hungry at lunchtime tomorrow, too. Why didn't she think I would want my own leftovers? Did she want to order a dish to go so she would have dinner for tomorrow, too? Like the gentleman I am, I drove her home, the doggy bag on the back seat of my car. I dropped her off, never intending to call her again. And halfway home, my phone rang. It was her. I left my chicken picante in the car, she said. Would you mind driving it back to my house? Yeah, I'd mind. The problem with being a waiter and dating a customer? They think you live to serve. I said, oh, sure, I'll be right there. I continued straight to my house and polished off the picante before hitting the sheets. I'm the type of guy who will take the leftovers home, and my wife will make sure to tell me, don't touch that eggplant parm, I'm having it for lunch. And I'd say, what eggplant parm? Oh, I ate it at 4 a.m. on the way back from the bathroom. You better get something else for lunch. On the average six-hour shift at the Four Seasons, my first year, I made about $130 a night, including tips. If I worked four nights, I'd make around $500 a week or $32,000 a year. Factor in another $100 per week and free food, my job made me feel like I was living the high life. After 6 months in L.A., I met my modest goal of not going broke and crawling back to Illinois in shame. I had a job, good food, friends, a hangout, a life. And then, out of the blue, my landlord called to say an apartment had opened up on the opposite side of the building, and I could move there whenever I wanted to. I opened up my curtains for a quick peek, and there was Paul standing in the window with his dick pressed against the glass, waving at me. I said to the landlord, I'll take it. I moved into an identical unit that faced Hollywood Boulevard, a few blocks away on that street, the Hollywood Walk of Fame. Madame Tussauds, the cement footprints of legends outside the Grauman's Chinese Theater. At work, I serve the stars. On my own block, I could walk in their footsteps. I was right in the middle of it all. Every day I could touch, taste, smell, and serve the drinks to the life I dreamed of. In terms of getting anywhere in comedy, however, I might as well have been living on the moon. I wasn't doing much in entertainment, but L.A. was sure the hell entertaining me. Chapter 2. Cooking Lessons. One question that comes up a lot in comedy is, are people born funny? Is a sense of humor in your DNA like brown eyes and intelligence? If so, then everyone in my family was born with it. And so were all my friends. Nothing was valued higher in my crew or family than cracking each other up with a good joke. The ultimate trash talk burn. My friends and I would tear each other to pieces laughing so hard we cry. A witty observation or just a stupid face. I remember being a little smiley and watching as my parents and their friends belly laughed around a kitchen table. Making my parents laugh was, for me, like scoring the winning rim shot at the buzzer. We all crave our parents' approval, and I got it whenever I said or did something funny. The sparkle in their eyes beamed directly on me. Sounds corny, but my family was my first audience. The kitchen was my first stage. I felt the most comfortable there, acting out stories, doing impersonations. An impression that always killed at the table was Christopher Lloyd's Reverend Jim Ignatowski from Taxi. I would go into okey-doke in the way he would say it, and it was a sure home run. These were the early stages of being a performer. When someone got out of their chair to demonstrate a story, A, it better be funny, and B, it better be quick. I would share stories about school and my friends. Dad would share stories about his clients and work. My mom would add in witty commentary and always laugh at both of us. My sister didn't participate in those nights until she was older. As we helped ourselves to multiple servings of whatever it was for dinner, we would talk into the wee hours of the night like it was Thanksgiving. When we went over to my grandparents' house, my goal was to make them laugh too. Problem was, they didn't speak English. And I know, it's a cardinal sin that I never learned Italian. We were too busy correcting my father's English to learn another language. This communication barrier with my grandparents forced me to develop a way to make them laugh through facial expressions and physical movements. Meanwhile, in elementary school, I turned the dial way down. If at home my volume went to 11, at school I held it down to about a 2 max. Class clown? Not me. I flew so far below the radar, I don't even think the teachers knew I was in the classroom. I was the quiet kid in the back, sitting stiffly, taking it all in, observing the world around me. And then when I got home, I'd wrap my observation into stories and jokes and present them to my parents like gifts. The first time I called attention to myself in a big way at school was in fourth grade, when I had to present an oral book report to the whole class. I was a wreck about it. Get up there in front of everyone and talk nonstop for 5 whole minutes? I had my first case of stage fright, which on top of my being an anxious kid in general was frankly terrifying. I would watch everybody get up there and say, Abraham Lincoln was our 16th president of the United States. He wore a tall hat and had a fucked up beard, or whatever the hell they would say. We all got up at 6 a.m. to catch a bus in a snowstorm to come to school, and this is the performance you're giving? I looked at everything as a performance, and I could never handle sitting through something boring. You have to give people something worth the price of admission. If I had been casting a show called Life, none of them would have gotten the part. They were dying up there. I couldn't get up there and continue to put the audience to sleep. I had to show them how it was done, or not do it at all. My teacher, Mr. Fitzgerald, said if I didn't do the report, he'd have to call my parents in for a conference to talk about it. My dad would have been pissed if he had to leave work. My mom would fret. Whenever my parents were brought in for a conference, my mom didn't care so much about my grades. All she would ask is, "But is he popular?" She was bullied as a kid, so she hoped her kids would not have to go through the same thing she did. I hated the idea of stressing her out, and of course embarrassing her, as in my son flunked fourth grade. The only thing that scared me more doing 5 minutes in front of a tough crowd of fourth graders was upsetting my parents. I wanted to make them proud. My father was a great music lover, especially R&B. While my friend's parents listened to the Beatles and Elvis Presley, my father blasted Grover Washington, Ramsey Lewis, Lionel Richie, The Four Tops, The Temptations, and Miles Davis. He would pay the bills listening to jazz sax only. My mother danced to Marvin Gaye's Sexual Healing while scrubbing dried lasagna off the dishes. I felt like I lived in a black house with nothing but black music. When my friends got into bands like Motley Crue, I would say, "What the hell is that?" To me, metal wasn't music. It was noise. On TV, they watched Tom and Jerry while I was obsessed with Soul Train. I recorded and studied it every week to learn the moves. I would go to school, and the smartest kid, Eddie Labenhofer, brought in an active volcano he made over the weekend. I think very impressive, Eddie. But can you do the Running Man? Eddie would pop his arm up to answer one science and history question after the next, and I'd think, "Yeah, good for you, kid. But do you have any idea who Don Cornelius is or his enormous impact on society?" The legendary Soul Train line dance was way more interesting than a science fair project to me. Don Cornelius, the show's host and creator, with his fro and soothing voice, gave the black community a place to boogie and taught this Italian-American 8-year-old how to groove. All of my idols were black: Michael Jackson, New Edition, Belle Biv DeVoe, Boys to Men, Eddie Murphy, Richard Pryor, Michael Jordan. Murphy always seemed animated, free, physical, and real, and I gravitated towards that. The book I chose for my report was the biography of Stevie Wonder. Why him? He was one of my dad's favorites, and according to the biography, Stevie led an incredible life, giving me plenty of material to draw from. But I wasn't going to tell his story. Every kid did his report that way, and they were so boring. I had to make mine entertaining for the class to watch and for me to perform. I made my parents and friends laugh doing impressions, and I'd seen Eddie Murphy, Stevie Wonder on Saturday Night Live. I decided with the confidence and balls of a much older kid, like 12, that I'd do my report as Stevie. I practiced for days in front of the mirror in my room, the school library. I scrolled through microfiche photos of Stevie. I got my hands on a VHS tape of Eddie Murphy's impression, and I studied it. I couldn't have been better prepared, but I was still anxious. With my sweaty armpits, I waited for my turn to do the report, and when Mr. Fitzgerald called my name, I sprang up. I ran out of the classroom and returned a moment later wearing the dark sunglasses and hat I'd see Stevie wear on TV. For some reason, my father had bought the perfect pair of sunglasses on Taylor Street, a place that saw white customers about once a year. Probably my father. He thought black people were snazzy dressers, and he always wanted to have clothes that nobody else had. He didn't buy the hat or glasses specifically for my report, but some things are just meant to be. Quick story about me wearing Dad's Taylor Street finds. One night in high school, I went out to meet my friends in my father's red leather lace-up shoes. If you came out in a new pair of shoes or a new shirt or a hairstyle, anything different, my friends would rip you to shreds. That night, I remember getting, "Circus in town," and, "Are you one of Super Mario Brothers?" While I was trying to pick up a girl, they started humming the Super Mario Brothers theme song. The unspoken rule was, and still is, you have to be able to dish it out and take it. If you showed any signs of weakness, it would be an invitation for them to rip you even more. In my Stevie Wonder costume, I made a big entrance, stage left, my heart jackrabbiting in my chest. As I crossed to front and center of the room, my head aimed up at the ceiling, my neck swiveling, a Stevie grin pasted on my face. I could feel the entire class wake up, and then they started clapping. I waited for the sudden and surprising applause to die down. Instead of a dry start like Stevie Wonder was born May 13th, 1950, I did an impersonation of my subject's high voice and said, "Hi, my name is Stevie Wonder. I was born May 13th, 1950. I must have looked like a girl because when I was born, my mother said, 'Isn't she lovely? Isn't she wonderful?'" The class went nuts. I played it up, swaying, pretending to flip my dreadlocks. And I kept going with my report. From my opener to my closer, the other kids never once stopped laughing. I got some major howls, some nervous giggles. Kids looked from me to Mr. Fitzgerald dumbfounded, like, "Can he do this? Is this allowed? Is he gonna get in trouble?" Look, fourth graders will, generally speaking, roll on the floor laughing over a fart, but just maybe the class laughed because my impressions and jokes were a premium quality comedy. This prepubescent audience was stunned. This wasn't the Jetsons or Flintstones. This was highly developed SNL type humor. I got my first taste of what it felt like to perform in front of people outside of my dinner table. I told my second grade teacher that I wanted to be a stand-up comedian. Who knew my first set would come just 2 years later? After that breakthrough report, got an A. Thanks, Mr. Fitz. I wasn't quite as shy anymore. The kids expected me to be funny now, and I liked the attention. I had developed this ability at the kitchen table, in ripping sessions with my friends, studying comedians on TV and at the movies, and perfecting my impressions in my bedroom mirror. I had a killer Michael Jackson, too. I developed my sense of humor like the basketball players practiced on the court, but I also had the awareness that if the funniness hadn't already been in my blood to begin with, it wouldn't have mattered how much I worked on it. So to answer the question, is being funny something you're born with? My answer would have to be yes. I was funny at home before I took my show on the road to school. With the positive response, I let my humor show, and it came out more and more. I worked at it, but I didn't have to try too hard to be funny. I just was. Like my parents, like my friends, I was always around funny people, and that raised my game for all of us. Funny was like food. It was on the table. It was a source of connection and attention. Funny was how I related to people. And after age 9, to myself. The next question that comes up a lot is, can a person learn to be funny? If you weren't born with it, but really, really wanted to be funny, could you take a class or something? Could comedy be taught? Comedy could absolutely be taught, just like acting, dancing, and writing. It is being taught all over the place. Type into Google stand-up comedy class plus your zip code, and I bet you could find the class for the weekend within driving distance. Whether comedy is successfully taught, however, it's debatable. Let me back that up. I happen to know for a fact that any person born funny or unfunny who takes a course of 8 Saturday seminars with a professional comedian at a reputable club who does the homework and puts in the effort will be able to pull together a 10-minute stand-up comedy act. It will not utterly humiliate that person if it's performed in front of a live audience of his or her best friends and beloved family members. But should that person devote his or her life to comedy? Talent is a determining factor in all success stories. You cannot be talented at everything. I learned